Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner and my co-host,
Tom Majeur.
And we are here with a very special Strong Tower Radio program concerning the coronavirus.
That's right. It's the interest of many, many people right now.
Right. It's in the news. We're hearing one thing, we're hearing something else. And on the phone joining us is Dr. John Kelly, who is the president of Oak Haven Health. He's also on the faculty, an adjunct faculty of Loma Linda University. Many of you know Loma Linda. It's a medical facility in California. And we welcome you to give us facts versus
hype.
Hype, things we're hearing. So thank you, Dr. Kelly, for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's going to be my pleasure to speak with your listeners because I think we have some very exciting and useful things to share today.
So one of the very first things, this coronavirus, everybody, I'm sure, knows about it. And so we want to talk about, what it is, because my understanding, this is what I've understood, is kind of like a flu, but there's different types of coronavirus, and so the coronavirus has been around for a while. So fill us in on what is fact.
Yes. Well, let me just first start off by saying that really nothing I'm thinking to share today would be intended to oppose or undermine or alter anything that the medical and public health experts are doing their best to tell us about this outbreak. So, I'm really want to say plainly that I endorse and believe that what the experts are saying and trying to do to help us in America with this outbreak, I'm supportive of, and nothing I'm saying for this hour is intended to oppose that. All right, but then to get to your question, really, coronaviruses are one type of many different families of viruses that can infect human beings and actually other mammals as well. For example, we all have had the cold, and that's usually caused by an adenovirus, it's called, that infects us primarily in the nasal passageways. But there's also different types of coronavirus, and some of those produce colds. We would call it a cold. The symptoms, runny nose, sinus congestion, maybe some mild fever, etc., discomfort. Another one is the flu virus, the influenza, and that one is probably the one that we encounter most often every year. And that's the one that, fortunately, there's usually the experts that study these things, because those viruses tend to start off in Southeast Asia and travel in the atmosphere to our continent and to Europe, in that general direction. They go from west to east. But so we have experts that are developing vaccinations every year that's specific to the most prevalent form of the flu virus. And that's why in some years it's a hard decision because there's more than one strain that's there. So you've probably heard of that. Some years there's two prominent strains and people get a vaccination and it doesn't cover them as well. But anyway, what I'm trying to get at is talking just in general about viruses and the problems that they cause. One of the things I think is very important for us to understand, let me just explain how a virus works in our body when we get exposed. So when a virus is actually not a living organism like a bacteria or like an amoeba. A virus is simply some genetic material inside of a protein capsule or capsid, they call it, and it's got little projections or appendages on it. We've all by now seen these little images in the news and elsewhere. It almost looks like some kind of a bomb that I've seen in the movies that for a depth charge, not a depth charge, when they used to lay mines for submarines and ships. But anyway, the little appendages are what would set off the bomb. Well, in this case, the appendages in a virus are how they are able to connect with a living cell, and it's, they sort of open the door for that viral genetic material to be deposited inside the cell. Because until that genetic material gets inside of a cell, it really can't do anything. And so once it is inside the cell, then the living cell has mechanisms that automatically say, oh, here's genetic material. We need to get that into the nucleus where it belongs. And so it hijacks the living cell. And what it does is the genetic material in a virus will, in most cases, will take over the production of proteins and what the cell's purpose is. It sort of hijacks and turns it into a machine for producing more copies of the virus. And it will produce copies of the genetic material and copies of the protein capsule and put them together and release them. And so it turns a living cell into a virus factory. And in the process, it creates the disease that whatever is associated with a cold or the flu, or in the case of this novel coronavirus, you know, we call it COVID-19. This particular strain of coronavirus has a formal name. It's SARS, Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome -COV for coronavirus -19. So this meaning it arose in 2019. There have been other coronaviruses that we've heard in the news. I don't want to just repeat what we already know, but the SARS virus back in, it was about 15 years ago or so, and it had in Asia, Southeast Asia. And then there was the MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, it's only been now about 10 years or so, maybe only 7 years since that happened. And those were both coronaviruses, okay? So the coronavirus has, interestingly enough, it has some versions or strains that are very mild. If they do infect us, we have little or no symptoms. We might think we had a cold, maybe runny nose. Others, however, can be so severe that they, like the MERS, had if I'm not mistaken, a fatality rate of over 30% of those who were infected were killed by the virus. So there's quite a range. Well, now let me say one other thing about this. The particular thing interesting about the novel coronavirus or this COVID-19, it is, how it gets into the body, how it gets into our cells, it has an affinity for a receptor on the cells that line the sacs in our lungs. These are alveoli, they're called. These tiny little sacs, they're so small that would barely be able to be seen with the naked eye, we're talking here. And this is where the air that we breathe in comes in close enough contact with the blood in our very tiny vessels that oxygen and carbon dioxide, you know, switch places. So the carbon dioxide in our blood gets into the air in the lungs, and the oxygen that's in the air goes into the blood, to the hemoglobin. So these very tiny thin-walled sacs called alveoli have cells on them that the cells have receptors, and these receptors for angiotensin converting enzyme 2, this particular receptor has been sort of hijacked by the virus. So the virus attaches to the receptor and it triggers the cell then to take the genetic material into the cell.
So I have a question for you. This mm-hmm. So this particular one, this, you know, coronavirus number 19, or, you know, whatever they're calling
it. Yes, 2019. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've never seen this strain before?
Yes, that is correct. As far as we can tell, and this has never been seen by humans. Mm-hmm. And what it is these viruses, and this again is in the news, so people may have read or heard about this, but it is pretty well known that all viruses have the ability to mutate to some extent, okay? Some can mutate very, very slowly. Others mutate very, very fast. And what that mutation is simply that the genetic material that's inside the capsule or the capsid changes a bit from one copy to the next. And so this mutation rate is accelerated whenever there is exchange of the virus between different species. So if you've got animals and human beings and living in very close contact and sharing their viruses back and forth in the air or in the water or however they're being communicated back and forth, they undergo more rapid mutation. And they so it's believed and reported that this particular, this novel coronavirus arose from this market where there was wild game and domestic animals and human beings in close contact. I don't doubt that. I don't have any proof yet. I don't think the world has, I'm not aware of us having proof that that's the source, but that's what the experts have told us, and it certainly makes good sense.
So a lot of us could have already had a form of the coronavirus. Like you said, we might have thought it was a cold or...
I would actually guess that the majority of us that are adults have been exposed to some kind of a coronavirus already, yes.
Well, I know in February, I was... Well, when I went to Loma Linda, all of a sudden I got sick, this cold, this congestion, and cough. And my husband was like, "You got the coronavirus." But I was never—I never had a fever. But for 2 weeks, over 2 weeks, this hung on, this cold and congestion, and and so I'm thinking, well, I had something. I don't know exactly what it was.
Well, you know, that's what's so interesting about this. There's I want to just say something here for our listeners, especially, and that is, with all due respect to the freedom of the press, and I cherish that dearly. One of the downsides of our American First Amendment right is people have the right to say anything in the world.
And they do.
It's right. It is. And so, again, trying to be gentle, but we've had things being said, are still being said in some avenues that are just not correct or not helpful. And some are downright, I studied viruses. I mean, I'm a medical doctor, but I also had a special interest in the immune system and virology, and I studied those things in my undergraduate degree. And you can tell this sometimes that what they're saying is not possible. It does not make sense with what we know about science. So, so what I want to say is, and I'm a consumer, and you always wonder, okay, if I get information, how can I know if it's reliable or not? Because it's not my expertise. And what I would say is it's very important to use the right sources. When you don't have the ability to know if what you're listening to or hearing or watching is right or wrong, then you need to check the credentials. And so I really believe it's important. So the thing I want to say is that we've got too much hype about this. I don't believe that we should be calling this novel coronavirus the deadly coronavirus. It's good grief. Some strains of flu have a kill rate or a death rate, or what do you want to say, a fatality rate that's as high as what we've seen with this coronavirus. Number one, of course, if my family is the one that gets sick and dies, I don't care how few there are, that was my family. That's a tragedy. And I certainly recognize that any death from any disease is a tragedy. But to call it I do not understand why we even ever called it the deadly whatever. It's that characterizes it in a way that I think overhypes the reality. The other thing, I do want to say that it can be deadly. There are definitely people that die from this, but keep in perspective. We don't call it the deadly flu virus, do we? And yet the flu kills people.
Right.
Well, and in the past, I mean, tens of thousands of people have died from the flu, is my understanding. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Oh, considerably more than that. In fact, one of the epidemics that we had in the U.S. about 100 years ago, it was the Spanish flu, so-called Spanish flu, in 1918 and 19. The figures I saw just recently looking this up was about just under 700,000 people that died from that over the period of that 2 to 3 year. I'm not sure if it was just 2 years. It might have been a three-year span. But anyway, parts of three different years. And I wanted to comment on that because, to put it in perspective, I would characterize the Spanish flu as a deadly flu because it was a pandemic and we lost you know, hundreds of thousands of people. But that is not what's happening, even in China, where some of the worst first part of this epidemic and some really high death rates. But they were fortunate. You know, the Spanish flu, for example, killed children. It was very dangerous to young people. And this particular virus, thank God, what I read, and I've been looking to try to find the facts, looking at medical articles and things from the CDC, there are either few or no children that have died from this at this point.
Well, that's what they put out on, you know, on the news that,
yeah.
So, but I want to ask you another question now, because you've used the word epidemic and pandemic. What is the difference?
Great question. So an epidemic is when you have an outbreak that gets out of control. So an outbreak is where you have something like you can have food poisoning at some kind of a civic club, and that would be an outbreak of food poisoning. And if that food poisoning then started spreading, we would call it an epidemic. If that spread became global, where it was happening for everyone in the country or everyone on the planet, then we would call it a pandemic. So
okay.
this strictly speaking, and I have a master's degree in epidemiology. I don't practice as an epidemiologist, but I was trained as one. And I would say that the definition most correct one is to say this is pandemic at this point in certain countries. There's no doubt that they're having a pandemic, for example, in Italy, in China. And the question is still whether we need to call it a pandemic in the U.S. or not. I don't have a burden. The only difference is between an epidemic and a pandemic is how widely and totally spread it is. So, you know, we've got it in 34 states, I think, was the last number I saw. It's going to be in all 50 states. That's 90-some percent, 99% certain that will happen. And in fact, I believe in the future, we're going to have coronavirus in society, just like we have the flu virus. So it's not going to be, Ebola is, for a comparison, the Ebola virus, which had a 70 to 80% kill rate, very deadly and very fast killer. But those kind of viruses don't spread well. People catch it and die so quickly, there's not a lot of spread. The most dangerous thing for spreading is one that you get it and you have no idea you have it, and then you spread it to a lot of people, and then you start to get sick and it kills you. So this is, on the scale of things, this is a serious outbreak, but it is not nearly as deadly as many we've had in the past.
Okay, well, stay tuned, folks. We have to take a quick break. But we have more information, maybe talking about containment, what can we do. So stay tuned. We will be right back with Dr. Kelly to talk about more facts regarding the coronavirus.
Hello, friends. This is Doug Batchelor with Amazing Facts. And thank you for listening to Bible Answers Live on Strong Tower Radio. To find out our broadcast times, simply go to strongtowerradio.org.
Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner with my co-host,
Tom Majeure,
with a special Strong Tower Radio program regarding the coronavirus. And we've been talking to Dr. John Kelly, who is the president of Oak Haven Health, which is located right here in Michigan. And he's also with the adjunct faculty of Loma Linda University.
And he also studied as an epidemiologist, too. So he knows what he's talking about.
We talked about what the coronavirus is in our first segment. And now let's talk about, you think you have a cold, a really bad cold, a really bad cough, because that's what I had. What are the symptoms in that maybe you should go to the doctor or the hospital, and then how do they decide to test?
That's, Jolene, that's a great question, and I have people asking me that all the time. Because, the majority, I mean, the experts, and I agree with them, 80% or better of the people who actually get infected with this new novel coronavirus will not know it. They will think they have a bad cold, or some may feel like it's a pretty mild cold that they have. Some will feel like, oh, this is, you know, this is the worst flu I've ever had, because it's very similar symptoms, because they're all respiratory disease. They're attacking our respiratory system.
So what are those symptoms that you feel? Is it coughing, or is it runny nose, or what is it that makes you, if in the worst case scenario, makes you really miserable?
Yes, well, and that's, and all of those things, actually. So the constellation that we say would set you, like, if they're screening, for example, they're screening people to find out, that are coming into the country to find out if they are infected, and what they're looking for are people who have cold-like symptoms or flu-like. So they have a cough, they have a fever, they might, some of them have, it's less common, but some have stomach upset or diarrhea also. But it's fever, a cough, and shortness of breath. And what is shortness of breath? Simply means that you feel like that you can't get as good air as you want to. You, if you do anything, you get out of breath from doing the least little thing. You certainly wouldn't think of going on a long walk. You just can't get your breath like you used to, and being able to do. So, and fever, yes. And so here's the thing. There is no... it's a subjective decision on the person's part. If you'd have no, now if you went to Wuhan, China, and you travel back home and you started getting a fever or a cold, you should go get tested, because you know you are in a place where there's lots of it. But if you're just doing your normal routine, going to work, doing whatever, church, wherever you go, and doing normal life, and you get some kind of respiratory thing starts bothering you, cough, flu, whatever, like, then that's probably what it is. It's probably just ordinary cold, ordinary flu bug. But if you start getting severe symptoms, or especially if you get where you can't seem to get your breath, even though you're not doing anything physically exerting, you're having trouble, then you should contact your physician and say, tell them the symptoms and ask them. They will make the call to say to you, okay, we'd like you to come in and evaluate whether we need to test you for the coronavirus. The thing is, they could, theoretically, we could pass out coronavirus tests, in the mail, and everybody would have one, but it would be, we would waste a lot of time and money testing everybody that had a cough. We need to, the doctors need to help us decide when to do this. But even, let's suppose that you get tested and you're negative, you do not have the coronavirus. But if you have a very serious case of the flu or whatever, and it's causing you to, be dehydrated or having high fevers that are endangering your health, you're going to want to go see the doctor, or maybe even be admitted to the hospital for that, because the flu can kill you. Mm-hmm. So it's, the bottom line is severity. And the thing to do is to communicate to your doctor or an urgent care, or if you have no, go to the ER and tell them what is going on, and they are the ones that will decide to do the coronavirus test or not.
So you talked about a fever. Is there a certain temperature above or below?
Yes. Yes, Eileen. We usually say 100.4 is the medical threshold. If you have a temperature of 100.4, not a temperature of 104, but mm-hmm. a temperature of 100.4, basically 100 and a half, then you have, we would say you have a fever. Now, I personally, I do not go, I'm a doctor, but I still go to doctors, when I'm sick. And I do not go see a doctor until my temperature gets beyond 100.4, because I feel like I understand the situation. But you technically have a quote a temperature if it's a 100.4 or above. I would say if it reaches up to 102, or if you literally simply are feeling flushed and you know you're having a fever and some people, the reason I say this is some people, their body does not create as high a temperature when it's sick as others. In fact, I read an article of the first 18 patients that were seen in Singapore. This was back in like January, early February, people that had come from China and either visiting relatives or coming back from. So anyway, they had 18 cases, and they gave a very detailed description of how the case evolved and so forth. And what they what their data showed was that those who needed supplemental oxygen, because that's how severe their condition was, they actually had a lower average temperature than the ones that did not need oxygen. And what we know is that this condition is more difficult for you if you have underlying disease. So anything that has impairing your health makes you more susceptible to this. And oftentimes that condition will also make your body not respond as vigorously and produce such a high fever. So I would say, 100, 102 is I would contact my doctor or nurse practitioner or whatever. If it goes up, spikes quickly and goes up to above 102, I would go to urgent care or to, I would. The other thing I want to say that's important, since I'm saying that, is the clinical records that we have available to us indicate that this is not something that kills you in hours. You don't have to think, oh my goodness, I'm going to get this, I'm going to get sick and die before I get to the hospital. It doesn't work that way. Even if you have underlying health problems, you have some days. I don't know how many exactly, but but I also believe, as a physician, better safe than sorry. If you're wondering if I need to go see the doctor, and you think you may have it, you should go see a doctor.
Well, I know when I was sick there, after I came home, I still had this, a smoker's cough, that was just, and then all of a sudden I'm like thinking, was I getting a urinary tract infection? Because most women, once they've had one, they know when they're getting another one.
Yes.
And then I thought a little fever. Well, I did go to urgent care, and, they had to do a urine specimen, and they thought, they couldn't tell me that that's what I had. But there was something was elevated. I don't know. But I had a temperature of 100.8. And
yes,
they were going to have to do a culture for a few days, but they gave me some antibiotics. I went home the next day, though, my fever was 101.8. And I'm like, no wonder I feel really bad.
Yeah.
They called me a couple days later and said I didn't have that. And so I stopped taking the antibiotic. But then I'm thinking, well, did I have a form of this coronavirus, or just like some kind of a flu or something? I don't know. But we're going to talk a little bit about things we can do, because I did do some things at home, I think, that helped me get through this.
Well, I'd like to share a couple of things, though, that I think are important. For example, we're hearing, and I agree with this, that it is not very useful to wear a mask if you're going to go out and you have to go shopping, you have to be around people. It will help us, but a very small amount. Wearing a mask to keep you from getting infected is very poor protection, as well. And we don't want people to think that you can wear a mask and so you're safe. I have to say that it makes a slight reduction in risk, but very slight. However, when you need to wear a mask is when you have a respiratory condition, whether it's coronavirus or flu bug or just ordinary cold. If you have sickness that it can be communicated by water droplets, from your coughing or sneezing, you should wear a mask, because that's the best way to protect others from getting what you've got.
So how effective is it if you have an illness that's transmittable? How effective is it to wear masks for others' benefit? You call that, we set off mic, self-containment. It's kind of a new word that I don't hear too often.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. It is very effective. As far as how, putting a exact number on it, I have not seen any numbers, but I can tell you that it reduces the risk greatly. And one of the things they say when you are out and you want to do social distancing, they say, what I'm hearing is approximately 2 meters or somewhere around 6 feet is so within 6 feet of someone who's has an infection, you're more susceptible to getting it than if you're beyond 6 feet. Well, putting on a mask on the sick person will cut that down considerably. You might be very close to the individual. You might even rub a shoulder on a bus if the person that's sick is wearing a mask, you have a much, much reduced risk of being exposed to what they've got. So I recommend to people, if you get sick and you have to go out, or if you want to protect your family members, wear a mask. Or if you don't have a mask, put a scarf or a kerchief or something that covers your nose and mouth, so that when you breathe or if you cough, you do not have this broadcast into the room.
So what I'm hearing is people that are well don't need to be wearing a mask to protect
Correct.
Themselves from others. It's the ones that, like when I had my cold, or you know, wearing a mask probably would have been a good idea.
Right. It's called standard precautions that we need to take on a, you know, and ideally we should do standard precautions even for the flu bug. But most of us are quite loose, I would say, and we don't wash our hands as often as we know we should. Maybe we touch our face and rub our eyes without thinking that, oh my goodness, I've touched four or five door handles. I've shook hands and now I'm touching my eye. And that's automatically, if I've got flu bug or corona bug on my hands and I rub my eyes, it's almost for sure I'm going to give myself an infection. And the other thing about the mask, it's not strictly speaking part of standard precautions, but it is standard, it's a standard way to protect others from our respiratory condition. So for example, in the hospital, if you go into a room where the patient has a communicable disease, you know, we try to have the patient have a mask, mm-hmm. and we also wear one ourselves oftentimes. So we're just trying to minimize the... But something I meant to say earlier, and I didn't get to say, was that why containment has a useful place. I may have mentioned it to you before we started the program, but the biggest thing that trying to contain the virus does right now is it keeps us from having an overwhelming need on our health system. If every one of us that's going to get sick this year got sick in a period of 1 week or 2 weeks, we would overwhelm the system. As a physician and a citizen, I fully expect that I will catch the coronavirus. I think the odds are better than
that's
50-50.
Kind of scary.
Well, it's not scary to me, and I'll tell you why. Because what we're going to talk about next, I hope, is we're going to because I'm taking measures to have personal immunity. I'm boosting my personal immunity to viral disease, so that if I'm less likely to get it, my immune system is more likely to fight it quickly if I do get it. The ones that are having the most trouble with viral diseases are those individuals whose immune system is sluggish about dealing with it. Our immune system is a properly functioning immune system would keep any of us from needing to die from coronavirus. It's because we have an impaired situation either with morbidities, you know, heart disease, diabetes, things that are interfering with our system, or we're on immune suppression from having a transplant of some kind, and we have, you know, drugs that are tamping down or dampening our immune system. A healthy immune system, and I think that's one of the reasons that children probably are doing so well, is that generally speaking, children have a healthy immune system. So containment makes some sense, it's not containment to keep it from reaching our shores. It's just containment to minimize the spread so we don't have a overwhelming need on our health system.
Well, and one thing I guess I've heard or seen, you know, listening to the news, is almost all of the deaths that have happened in the United States, they already had underlying health issues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially when it
That's
started
correct.
There in Washington, you know, in the nursing home. I mean,
that's the worst place. Yeah, that's the worst place.
And that's one thing. I don't know if that's every. I mean, I'm not 100% sure how many people have died as of, you know, this date we're recording this. But what I understand, almost every single one they've reported, they were already, like you're saying, their immune system, they already had something else going on in their body, you know, that
yes.
was causing them not the greatest of health.
Correct. That's correct. I mean, immune suppression is probably the most dangerous condition to have, because that's dampening our system from fighting viruses. And people who are on immune suppression know well that they, the doctor will give them antibiotics anytime, you know, so that anytime there's any kind of sickness, they can have help to fight it. But the thing is, viruses are not, cannot be fought with an antibiotic. Antibiotics do not, they fight living cells, you know, like microbes and so on. They cannot fight a virus. The one time that they do help in a viral infection is if I get a viral infection that leads my body to contract pneumonia. That is a microorganism. And then, yes, an antibiotic can help fight the pneumonia, but the antibiotic will do nothing really for viral disease. That's something we, our immune system has to take care of. And one thing also to say is that we're often, you know, we have immunity. Once we catch something like the measles or whatever, chickenpox, any of these viral diseases where we may be more familiar with, we have immunity because there are immune cells that now recognize the measles virus, and when we are exposed to it again, the immune system immediately says, bad guy, take care of him. And it doesn't take, you know, minutes to hours for a healthy immune system to say, hey, we've been exposed again. The first time you're exposed, it takes the immune system around 2 weeks to really gear up. Yes. And a very healthy immune system, I understand that might be 7 to 10 days, but in a typical, typically we say 2 weeks. That's why that's why we quarantine people for the 2 weeks, is so that we have time for the immune system to show the evidence that of this or not.
Are you saying that if we have 2 weeks of exposure of that and then we get exposed a second time, we're ready for that immunity at, because our has been built up?
Yes.
So time is on our side. If we can delay hand washing, avoid exposure or limited exposure, keep our immune system strong until our immunity kicks in 2 weeks, and then maybe we can fight it off?
Well, yes, that would, but that's not the what I was trying to get at. I would say that what you just described is possible, but the more likely thing that would happen is I would get exposed and my immune system would not be prepared, and so I would get the illness, I would have the symptoms, whatever it might be, severe cold or flu symptoms kind of thing, worse than that maybe. But the point is, I would get sick, and my immune system would take 10 to 14 days to start fighting back. By then, the illness has spread in my body, and I'm going to, you know, I can't. My immune system is not going to be able to stop this infection. What it will do is it'll get rid of it. I mean, the reason that we get well after we catch one of these is our immune system kicks in, recognizes, oh, this is a bad guy, and starts taking it out. Okay, so and then the next time that we are exposed to that same germ, it says, hey, I recognize this right away. And the reason that we get the flu over and over again is because, as I mentioned earlier, the flu and other viruses mutate, and so we get exposed to a new strain. Yes, it's flu, but it's the little appendages, the little things that it uses to attack our cells, it very cleverly changes the configuration, and so our immune system is fooled enough that it doesn't recognize, you know, the flu bug. But it quickly kicks in and gets rid of it after we have it.
Okay. Well, listen, folks, we've got to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and talk more about maybe our immune system, what we personally can do to help ourselves. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on the coronavirus, talking with Dr. John Kelly. Hi folks, Jelaine Fenner here. Do you want an easy way to support Strong Tower Radio and it won't cost you anything? When you're shopping on Amazon, just go to smile.amazon.com and pick Strong Tower Radio as your charitable organization, and they will donate 0.5% of the eligible purchase to us. That's smile.amazon.com. So you're going to shop anyways? Why not help Strong Tower Radio? Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner with my co-host,
Tom Majeure.
And we are doing a very special Strong Tower Radio program with Dr. John Kelly, who is the president of Oak Haven Health, and he's on the adjunct faculty of Loma Linda University. And we're talking about the coronavirus because it's in the news. It's all over the world.
We're talking about facts here, folks.
Yes, we are.
We're going to get down to the details. We're going to take the fear factor out and get down to things that you can do.
Yes, because we've been talking about what it is and maybe a little bit of containment. But now we want to talk. We talked briefly about our immune system because that's what keeps us healthy. Correct, Dr. Kelly?
That's right. In fact, the only thing we have really to fight viral diseases besides a vaccine, if we can make one, is our immune system. So we want it to be at optimum functioning level if we want to avoid viral disease or to get over it quickly.
So what can we do?
Yes. So first off, we just need to have good diet, basic things that we heard all along, good diet, and in particular, avoiding sugar and sweets. These foods have been shown to reduce the effectiveness of our natural killer cells and other parts of our immune system that we absolutely depend on to fight viruses, because viruses cannot be attacked with an antibiotic. Those are only for diseases that have living cells. And these things are our own cells become the enemy. We want to minimize processed foods because processed foods tend to have lower nutrient level and higher calorie level. They have additives that in many cases help to depress the immune system from being effective. We want to have lots of whole plant foods, especially cruciferous vegetables and the leafy greens have phytochemicals that have been shown to actually boost the immune system, make it more effective. We want to minimize things like dairy, cheese, and ice cream. I know we like those. I'm not saying we can't occasionally have some, but when you're wanting to avoid getting a viral disease, or if you think you have been infected with a cold virus or a flu virus or the coronavirus, you should immediately go on, okay, I'm going to have no sweets, none of this cheese and ice cream or whatever until my immune system fights this off. Another thing very, very important is sleep. Plenty of sleep. There's a reason that the old saying is the doctor says, take 2 aspirin, get plenty of sleep, and call me tomorrow. The point is, sleep is so vital. Don't keep working. When you know that you're starting to get sick and say, oh, I can't stop, I've got to work, you're going to make that disease episode worse than it would have been. If you will, as soon as we know that we're getting a bug, you can actually oftentimes thwart it in 2 or 3 days instead of it taking 2 to 3 weeks. So act quickly. Another thing is, especially for respiratory conditions, get regular moderate outdoor exercise. Not on the highway or the freeway, but out in a place where there's a green space, a park or the woods. There's negative ions and other things science has shown helps strengthen the respiratory system. Outdoor exercise every day if possible. Another thing that's worth mentioning, I'm not real big on supplement, and science has been published showing we do not in general need supplements to have good health, but we do want to keep our vitamin D, C levels at optimal levels when we know we're being exposed to virus diseases. And so if you've never had your vitamin D level checked, I would recommend doing that, because especially here in Michigan, we tend to have a little less vitamin D sunshine in the wintertime. Those numbers should be above 30 for the vitamin D level. Of course, vitamin C takes some of that. We also get plenty of vitamin C, actually, though, in fruits and vegetables. The point I'm making is just it's not a good time to be deficient on vitamins when we're trying to optimize the immune system.
Yeah, Dr. Kelly, we have listeners across the whole spectrum of health. You know, some are very focused on their health. This is their normal routine. There's others that at the other end of the spectrum care very little about their health and probably eat those junk foods and not enough sleep. How much do you have to change the dial if you're in poor health habits to make a difference that might reduce or help fight back the coronavirus or any virus in this family?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And what's really interesting is we have plenty of published studies now showing, let's take, for example, our exercise. If I'm a couch potato, actually almost any amount of physical activity produces a measurable benefit. Now, optimal benefit comes from probably having over 30 minutes most days. So say 5 or more days a week, more than 30 minutes of exercise. But if I merely get 5 or 10 minutes of exercise a day, from being a couch potato, that makes a significant improvement. So any, I would basically answer your question by saying any improvement has an effect. But there is one thing I would say, there is a threshold effect at the same time. So, and these two ideas are sort of...
Does that mean diminishing returns? Or the minimum that you need in order to get some health benefit?
Right. I'm talking about the minimum amount. So there are some things you need a minimum amount to get some benefit. And I just mentioned exercise. Almost any amount of moving is helpful. But when it comes to diet, there's a threshold effect. So what I mean by that is you say, let's suppose, you know, like I used to be, I ate steak practically every meal and ate my share of chicken and so on, deep fried stuff, things that we all know are not very healthy. Well, there was a movement 30 or 40 years ago that was like to take the skin off your chicken and then, you know, you'd really make them. Well, it turned out that the study showed that you could take the skin off the chicken and it still did not make, it didn't move the needle. So what we need to do in diet is there's a threshold effect and we do need to make a serious change. And here's the two key things that I believe you boil it down to. Number one, we need to reduce processed food, whether it's plants, animal, whatever kind of food it is. If it's been processed, turned into pastries or turned into processed meat, etc., bologna, hot dogs, and so on, those things are much more harmful than the less processed. The second thing is plant foods. We absolutely need to have a lot more plant foods in our diet than we're typically getting. The statistics, the numbers from the experts say we're less than 3 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, and that's including ketchup as a serving.
Oh, no.
I would call that a processed food. But the point is we're miserably short on. We've got to eat more.
How many servings would you recommend?
Well, I think that there's no upper limit, frankly, to
it. What about our threshold?
The public health people say is 5+. But the reality is 9 or more is what we should aim for. But if you're, again, your original question was, if I have a terrible diet, poor health habits, what do I need to do to get some benefit? Well, one serving of vegetables per day added to whatever you're eating, that will be beneficial. But to get a real boost to the immune system, I would say my expert opinion is that we need to cut out the processed and empty calories. Sure, if you're drinking sodas, for example, or if you're smoking, by the way, I didn't say this, but frankly, all this other stuff, if you're smoking, that's the single most important thing that you should stop doing when you're trying to boost your immune system. Yeah, sugary drinks are very harmful to the immune system, but so is actually cheese. It's high in saturated fat, and it has a negative effect on the immune system.
So what I see so far, you're talking about reducing the meats to the threshold of plant food, reduce processed food, eliminate smoking. Of course, that's difficult for people. Reduce the sugar and cheese.
And yes. I just want to mention, so people, processed food, almost everything that's in a box. I mean, we open up a box, you know, and whatever it is, we're going to add water or stick it in the microwave. I mean, you know, you got frozen foods, you know, the TV dinners. That's what you're talking about when we also are saying processed foods.
Yes, exactly. We cannot recognize it. Potted meat, bologna, sausages, these things are all highly processed animal foods. Cheese, ice cream, these are highly processed. Cookies, candies, sugary drinks. But it's really easy to know what a plant food is, okay? If you can recognize it, that it was a plant.
And it's in its original form.
That's good. That's something you want to eat more of.
You know, carrots. We flew on the airplane, and just before we got there, we got our last tank of gas, filled up the rental car, and we thought, well, we haven't had breakfast yet because we got up at 3:30 in the morning. And so we thought, well, maybe we could get something in the store. In that convenience store, we could get bottled water. There was an apple and a banana. Other than that, everything else in the store
processed.
Was processed. Everything. There was not one thing we could buy that wasn't processed except for those three items.
Yes. I'm glad to hear that they had an apple and banana.
Yeah.
But I run into that all the time as well. Yeah.
We need to talk about something else because it's something that I do to help myself, to help boost our immune system. And it has something to do with water, not just drinking it.
We call it hydrotherapy. There's a growing amount of science published on this. Sometimes it's called water immersion or water therapy. But anyway, we're used to calling it hydrotherapy. That's what they called it 100 or 150 years ago. It's using water to Well, of course, drinking water is important. I don't want to miss that. It is very important to stay well hydrated when you have a respiratory condition, because this virus is making your lungs give off and release a lot more fluid. It's taking fluid out of your system. It's dehydrating you. So you need to drink extra water.
So not coffee, not tea, but water.
Yes, water is the ideal beverage for the immune system. Some of the herb or green teas can be good as well. But yes, just water is optimal. But I want to talk about, as you said, external. I want to talk about using water to actually change the physiology or to modulate the physiology of our body. So it turns out that when we get sick, we've been talking about this earlier, if you get sick and you get a fever, then you start to be concerned. And if the fever gets high enough, you say, okay, I really need to go see a doctor, make sure if I need something additional to get over this condition. Fever is part of the body's natural way to fight illness. What it does in the viral diseases, it sort of ramps up or accelerates it, the immune system. It puts the immune system on steroids, as the common saying goes. Well, actually, from a medical standpoint, steroids actually depress the immune system. But this is a figure of speech.
Yeah. Right.
But anyway, so it really pumps up the immune system. So what we've found that we can do is we can induce a fever. We can raise the body temperature in the early period of an infection, and actually, you might say, prompt the immune system to act more vigorously. And I use this all the time. I've learned, as you said a while ago, about you can sort of tell when you're starting to get a cold or get something. And when I first hint that I have, that I'm catching something, I'm getting a funny feeling in my throat, or I'm starting to have some sniffles, I will start doing hot and cold shower. I'll tell you just a second a little bit more what I mean by that. And I will especially use what I call a hot half bath fever treatment. And so let me explain what that is. But first let me say that what we're trying to do here is we're actually using water temperature to alter our body temperature, and in the process boost the immune system's ability to fight off disease or to resist it. And so let's talk about the hot and cold shower. This is the easiest one. My wife, Sally, actually, almost every shower she takes, she does this. She just likes it, and she knows it's good for her immune system. What it is you take a shower, and then once you've finished your normal shower, you turn the water temperature up. I usually do it gradually over a period of 3 or 4 minutes, and I just get it up until, the shower is steamy. And I'm really moving around a lot. I'm rubbing my arms and legs because mechanical friction actually accelerates the beneficial process. So, plus, it helps me take a higher temperature of the water without feeling like it's hurting me. And I get this up. Now, I don't want to burn myself, but I do want it hot. Then, after 2 or 3 minutes, I turn it down. I love those showers that have a single lever, because you can just turn that knob or that lever to cool. And the first time I turn it, I honestly only go to cool or somewhere between cool and cold, because I just can't stand all the way
the cold
the first time. Yeah, but it's going to give a shock. And for about 30 to 45 seconds, I just jump around and rub myself and try to get that water running over all of my body as much as possible. And then after 30, 45 seconds, I flip it back now to hot. And this time, interestingly enough, it doesn't feel hot at the same temperature I had, so I actually turned it up a little bit more, and I do this for 2 to 3 minutes. I don't put it on my head. I don't want to heat my head up, so I don't put this hot water on my head. And then I flipped it back. So I do this 3 times. There's actually science published on this. There's diminishing returns. There's the first 3 times give significant benefit, the 4th, 5th, a little less, quite a bit less, actually. But by the 6th, there's no point in doing it 6 or 7 times. That actually doesn't do anything that you haven't already accomplished with the first 3 or 4. You can do this in about 15 or 20 minutes if you do 3 or 4 iterations. And always end with a cold, but not the full. I would do, like, say, not more than 30 seconds. So in any water treatment or hydrotherapy, you do not want to get chilled. You do not want to get where your teeth are chattering or feeling chilled. That didn't have enough warmth. But you also like to end with a cool, because it actually closes the pores mm-hmm. of your body and helps this treatment be more effective. And I have published studies in my records showing that this can increase the circulating immune cells by 400%, or you can have 4 to 5 times the amount of circulating cells in your bloodstream for up to 24 to 32 hours.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, it's a wonderful asset to sort of, it puts the immune system on call, you might say. Like, you know, when we have a national emergency, they call up the reserves, and oftentimes they'll have others that are on standby. So this takes your immune system from standby to being on duty.
So if people want to learn more about hydrotherapy, like if they typed in hydrotherapy, and there's books, what should they do?
Yes, there are some books on hydrotherapy, excellent ones. I have three or four in my own library. I do not recall, I'm sorry, the specific titles. But in general, the search on the word hydrotherapy, you'll find books with that title. You can go to YouTube. I've seen a couple mm-hmm. of different ones that are free and very good. I think you had actually, didn't you have the Smiths on your program? I think I heard them talking about natural remedies.
Yes,
hydrotherapy. Mm-hmm. And they actually have a video, if I'm not mistaken, that about doing those kind of treatments. Mm-hmm. So you could actually get a video and right. learn all about it.
So listeners, you need to go online and look up hydrotherapy, and you will learn a lot. I've been taking hot and cold showers for 20, 30 years, and I shock my system, even though I've been doing it. And every time I take a shower, I end up with very hot on my feet, especially. I put it all over my body, but especially my feet. And then I turn it all the way to cold.
Yes. And, my goal is to get it all the way to cold by the last one, at least. Can I say one other thing I wanted to mention about that? And that is that right now I'm out of town. I'm visiting a town I haven't been in before. So I'm taking a hot and cold contrast shower every morning just to keep my immune system boosted. But if I come down, or I think I'm coming down with something, I will do it two or three times a day. Mm-hmm. I mean, I assume that if we did this every hour, it would be too much. You could do three or four or five of these in a day without hurting yourself. I would do it two or three times a day if you think you're fighting a bug, and it can really make a difference.
I think, Tom, we need to have a program regarding hydrotherapy.
Absolutely.
And talking about programs, Dr. Kelly is going to be in the Cadillac area on Tuesday, March 24th, and he will be at the 13th Street Seventh-day Adventist Church, which is located at the corner of M115 and 13th Street in Cadillac, doing a program at 6:30, and you're going to talk more about what we can do to help our immune systems, correct?
That's true. I'm going to be talking about many of the things we did today, but of course, in person, I'll be able to give some information I can't do on the radio.
Sure. Okay. So, folks, if you're in the Cadillac area, please come Tuesday. That's March 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the 13th Street Seventh-day Adventist Church. And Dr. Kelly will be there talking about most of the things we have talked about. And, and probably this is only an hour program, and that program might be about an hour and a half. So we'll get more information from him. So we appreciate this, Dr. Kelly. And we hope that our listeners will be benefited by learning more truth, especially regarding this coronavirus.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I hope and pray that all of your listeners will benefit from making some simple preparations and not letting the hype scare us. We just need to be sober, smart, and calm. And if we do catch something, let's do protect others by trying to self-contain or quarantine, wearing something over our nose and mouth if we have to be among people.
That's because many of us go to work. I know I get yelled at when I've got a cough and I come to work. All right, well, folks, thank you so much for joining us for this special program, and we just pray that it has benefited you.
Bye now.